We wouldn't be able to keep this archive going without your support. Donate online today at wyxr.org. Oh, but your hook was in me to stay. Now you got me.
I'm Melissa Martin, and I love to garden, and you're listening to WYXR 91.7 FM, Memphis.
You are blessed beyond your wildest imagination and don't know it. Because the world that I grew up in, my testimony is not wondering where my next meal was going to come from.
This is a journey.
Let me take you on a journey.
There will still be a journey.
It's a journey.
New sheriff in town.
The journey.
Journey.
This thing is bigger than Nino Brown. This is
the journey.
The journey.
What is it that moved you?
The journey.
Welcome back to another episode of The Journey. I'm your host, Larry Robinson, and today we have a Memphis icon that I know you're going to love. But before we get to this Memphis icon, let me give you a little quote. The quote comes from Marion Wright Edelman, and it goes like this. You're not obligated to win. You're obligated to keep trying to do the best you can every day. And what's that mean? That means you might not always be successful. You might fall down, skin your knees, bump your head, but you got to keep going every day. That's mandatory because that's what we made of. So listen, this gentleman, Bishop Ed Stevens, Golden Gate Full Gospel Baptist Church. He's a pastor. He's an entrepreneur. I mean, the Golden Gate Development Corporation. But more importantly, he's a son, a husband, father, and a visionary leader. Oh, and I forgot. He's a member of the Crimson and Cream. He's of that gang, the men of Kappa Alpha Psi. So he's my frat brother. But better than that, he's got three noobs in his house. Well, they ain't in his house no more. They done went on. But nevertheless, without further ado,
yeah.
Bishop.
Larry.
Hey, Stevens.
Thank you, man. Good to be here. Absolutely.
How you doing, man?
Man, listen, we on top telling the Lord ta-ta. He's good. Yeah, I arrived to your world, so I know I have arrived.
You arrived. Okay. All right, then. Well, you know, shoot, man. I'm honored to have you here,
Thank
man.
You for the invitation. Absolutely.
You have been someone that I have looked up to since my early days in Memphis, man. So
thank you.
So keep
thank
doing so the great much. Work yeah, you're doing in the Raleigh area and whatnot. But we going to try to give people some background on the brother.
All right.
So, you know, I know you went Valentine. Was it Snowden?
And
then Treadwell. So you ran at North Memphis, straight out of North Memphis.
Straight out of. No, I say North.
Yeah.
There is a North Memphis.
North.
There's a North Memphis, and there's a North Memphis.
Okay.
I was in North. Let's be clear.
Okay. All right. Then. Okay. So let's talk about those early days in North Memphis. What do you remember about the neighborhood? Tell me about the neighborhood you grew up.
Listen, we were really blessed. You know, of course, my mom, dad, mm-hmm. you know, it was two of us, my brother and myself. Mm-hmm. And my mom was a teacher. My father was, of course, a pastor.
Okay.
As well as worked for the postal
service. So your mom was a pastor?
No, my father.
Your father was a pastor.
Father was a pastor. Mom was a teacher.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, mom was a teacher in school system. And my dad pastored Oak Grove Baptist Church on 64.
Okay.
And so my brother and myself. And so we grew up, I guess you would call it, middle class African-American family and that kind of thing. So I had a lot of positive memories about growing up in the community that we did. I recall clearly we were probably the second African-American family to move on our street. It mm-hmm. was a Jewish community. They moved out and blacks were moving in. And I remember all those days.
Oh, wow.
Real
wow.
well.
So yeah. Who outside of your parents had the biggest impact on young Ed Stevens?
You know, I was always around people.
Okay.
So I don't think there's one other person when I was young that had an influence. Mm-hmm. When I started preaching and who I saw that really helped shape me for what I do now mm-hmm. was my pastor, Archbishop Leroy Bailey. He was Pastor Leroy Bailey, pastor mm-hmm. his First Cathedral Church, but mm-hmm. he's from Memphis.
Now, you said, you know, you the other son.
I gotta do my research. I'm the other son. I claim that title. With my pastor for sure.
Yeah, all his kids are looking at you what's wrong with this dude? He ain't one of us.
They know. They don't accept it from anybody. They accept it from me.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it was through his life.
Okay.
And just watching him from afar. And then I heard him. He was in town preaching a revival.
Uh-huh.
And I invited him to my church. And thus, really, our relationship mushroomed.
Okay.
And I needed that in my life at that time. Of course, my grandfather was a pastor.
Oh.
And my dad was killed in a car accident going to a wedding in 1972. Oh. I was 12 years old.
Ooh.
Would have been turning 13. So, okay. But my grandfather, my mom's dad was a pastor also.
Okay.
And so a couple of years later, we went to serve with my grandfather.
Right.
That's actually where I started ministry. I preached my first sermon at my grandfather's church.
Okay.
New Fellowship Baptist Church on Brown. Right. It's a little small church right behind. It's torn down now. It had a fire. But it was right behind Northside.
So wait a minute. You got like four pastors.
It's more. That's five generations altogether.
Yeah.
Yes, five generations. I go back past him to my great-grandfather, my grandfather, my father, myself, and now my sons.
How different are you from the person you dreamed you'd be as a kid?
Quite different, I want to think.
Okay.
I want to hope that I have grown immensely and my mind has stretched.
So did you see yourself as a musician, an athlete?
I was not the athletic type. I was in the drama club.
Okay.
And Miss Florence Roach was my speech and drama teacher.
Wait a minute, Flo Roach,
Doc, taught me.
Oh, man, now, see, now, when you come back, Flo might be here. Now, yeah. Flo is doing a lot of work.
I owe a lot to her because as far as public speaking and things of that nature, going through my drama courses and all that and going to the Thespian Association in Washington, D.C. So
really?
My mind expanded. Yeah, absolutely. When I was in 11th grade, so she was my teacher.
So you was going to be a star.
I don't know what I was going to be. I was 15. I was finding my way at that time for sure.
Okay.
But my pastor was really influential in my life as far as the career that I'm in now, without a doubt.
You know,
I had my grandfather that thing, but we're generations apart that I could relate to and do ministry on another level than what I had seen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. As a young person, we tend to make decisions that impact us one way or the other. What is the decision you made as a young person that ended up having lifelong impact, even though you didn't know it would at the time?
I still believe without a doubt the call of ministry on my life is how I have to respond to that.
When did you know?
I actually knew before I had acknowledged it. I knew about when I was 8. No, my dad 12. Probably about 12 years old, right in that time frame, right before he passed. But I never said anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not until I was 19.
Okay.
Probably 17. But I spoke to my grandfather about it at that time. And we had a conversation. And that's when I really publicly acknowledge, hey, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Right.
And that kind of thing. I was 18. I was freshman, sophomore at University of Memphis, Memphis State at the
time. Okay.
Yeah. So that was kind of the path.
Is there a moment in your life where you can point to that God literally, you knew it was nothing but God?
Oh, absolutely. I'm just so glad you asked that question.
Yeah. So come on with
Listen,
it. Come on
let me
with
tell
it.
You how, and yeah. I, when I say I know, unequivocally, I know.
Okay.
That it was God. And that was when the church that I serve now, mm-hmm. I just told this story two Sundays ago.
Okay.
When I got the call to come to a vacant church, right. I was at my grandfather's church.
Right.
And the chairman of the deacon board at the church I serve now, mm-hmm. his son happened to be at a revival that I was preaching for my grandfather.
Right.
And he heard me preach, mm-hmm. and he asked, could I give your name? Because the church was about to have another pastor,
mm-hmm.
and he was leaving. So he said, can I give your name to my dad? He's mm-hmm. chairman of the deacon. I said, sure, no problem. The rest is history. But what happened was when I wasn't sure where the church was, when I found out where it was, that next morning, and I'm cutting across the field, but I get up, I go to this church, get out, go to the back lot and get on my knees and pray.
Mm-hmm.
That next Sunday, when I sat down in what was called the pastoral chair, fast forwarding, they end up calling me. Okay, to this church. That's what they call it. And that next Sunday, when I get there to start preaching, it was the last sermon that I preached for them. I knew that I had been engulfed by the Spirit of God. No doubt in my mind that was where I was supposed to be. It was a spirit of peace that was beyond my imagination. And I'm telling you this. I know this to be a fact that this is where God had ordained for me to be, because he gave me a sweet, sweet, sweet peace. And the church has had phenomenal growth. Wow. I had great people in the church. It was a good mixture of seniors, middle-aged, and then, of course, me being 26,
right.
young people started really coming
right.
out the gazoo, okay?
Right.
And the church continued to mushroom. We went from one service to two services. Then we added on at that building, went to three services, with all that kind of stuff that was taking place. So God just really had his hand on us. It was definitely him, because I hadn't been anything called church growth. All the things that I'm teaching my ministers and staff, none of that was not really popular at that time. I was really leaning and depending on God, you know, to develop the work and all that. So that's how we were.
All right. Last question of this segment. Most brothers can point to the moment when they realize they were a black man. What was that moment for you like? Hold on real quick. We're going to be right back on the journey. A brother, Bishop Newt Ed Stevens, is going to tell us when he realized he was a black man. Stay right there. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back on the journey. That's my Muhammad Ali look.
This is a journey.
Let me take you on a journey.
Welcome to Her Journey, presented by Kazukian Media Group.
We believe Her Journey will encourage young women and help them see that life is a journey.
You have to continue to walk in your purpose.
We cannot control how other people respond to us.
As long as you have breath in your body, story does not end. Every day that God grants you, you have an opportunity to rewrite your story.
Our mission is clear: to inspire and empower the next generation of women leaders, innovators, and change makers.
Her Journey chronicles the trials, tribulations, and triumphs of 10 phenomenal women right here in Memphis, Tennessee, who have pretty successfully navigated this thing called life. Watch Her Journey, hosted by me, Joy Doss, brought to you by the Kazukian Media Group and proudly sponsored by Nike, Black Community Commitment.
I told you we had a Memphis icon that was going to knock your socks off. Well, listen, before we left, we asked him about when he realized he was a black man. Hold up on that. What's your superpower?
My superpower is found in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 20.
Okay.
Now unto him.
Okay.
Who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power of the word that works in you. That's my superpower.
Ooh, you're going to have to break that down for the people in the back. Break it down for the people in the back, man.
Listen, here it is. If you break it up from an exegetical perspective, it's real
now,
simple.
What the heck does exegetical mean?
When you break it down and digest it.
Okay, there you go.
Here it is. Now.
Okay.
What a great way to start anything rather than right now. It's not tomorrow, not yesterday, right now.
Right.
Now unto him.
Okay.
Watch this. Right. Here's the next clause. Who is able?
Okay.
And that word, that ability.
Right.
Who is able to do? Because here's the key. The moment we recognize it's never been about our ability, but yielding to his ability.
Mm.
Now unto him who is able. And people walk around trying to figure themselves out and wondering why you never get anywhere because you're trying to do it in your own strength.
Mm-hmm.
But when you yield what you have over to the one who has the ability to do exceedingly. And I love what, and watch what God then says in the text. He says, now unto him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think. Now that tells me I can go ahead and go for the moon. And when I even get to the moon, you still haven't reached what he's able to do.
Ooh.
Now unto him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly. That word in the Greek is the word hypotitia. It means to superabound. You asked me about my supernova. It means to superabound. Now unto him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think. That's why I challenge people all the time. Go for it. Go for it. Don't limit yourself to a God who is limitless.
Mm.
Now unto him. So not just one station, but why not three stations? Why not five stations? Why not a station at the Agri Center and a station in Nashville, a station in New York? Now unto him, because we look at us and we are limited. But when we look to him, there is no limits, Doc. And so that's my power juice. That's my word that I live off of. I can go to a funeral and people are down and I'll drop that word on them. Here's how you're going to get through this. Now that your grandmother is not there, your mother is not. I know a lot of other scripture, but that's my word. That's my scripture that I live off of. And that helps me to press through when you're dealing with situations and business ventures and all that. And you run into some no's here and there. But now unto him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that you ask or think. But here's the key. According to the power of the word that works in us. That's the critical piece, because the more of the word that you have working in you, the more you'll be able to maximize your potential.
Let me tell you something. I've been going through something, and man, you have just preached the whole word to me just right here. You have preached the whole word to me, man. And thank you, man. People, I'm sorry. I am blown away because God keeps sending me these messages, man. And I'm thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Cause I'm on assignment. I'm not playing. I don't go everywhere. I'm on assignment. When it was you and you called my office, your staff called my office and they set it up. I'm on assignment wherever I go. And that goes back to that now unto him who's able. He can open a door that I can't open.
Right.
Now unto him who is able. And me to get here and see your team and your staff and folks that I've known for years when I got started. I knew God was up to something. He's always up to something.
Mm. Keep on preaching, brother. All right. Tell me about the household. Tell me about the household back in North Memphis.
The household, as far as...
You know, like, it was you and your brother.
Just me and my brother, yeah.
And your mother.
Yeah.
What'd your brother give you? What did you get from your brother?
A relationship that we have that's still strong today. A bond.
Okay.
Because I know that not all siblings bond.
Right.
Really bond.
Right.
And that was a period when he left. He moved. He went to Lamar and left and went to work for FedEx. Left Memphis and went to Nashville to work for FedEx. And that's where he's been for the last probably 40 years, I think now.
Okay.
And, but we're still close and we still talk three times probably a week, at least, you know.
Okay.
And, so he's back and forth, come see mom and et cetera.
Right.
But no, what he's given me is the fact that we both recognize the importance of family and relationship
mm-hmm.
and keeping that together. So
did you ever have to kick his butt?
Huh?
You ever had to kick his
butt? I was older than him, but yeah. Now here's the deal. Danny was chubby and I was skinny. But when he was little, I could get on top of him and hold him down. He ain't gonna admit that now, but I'm telling you, that's how it was. Yeah, so, you know, they know Stevie and Danny. They called me Stevie growing up.
Uh-huh.
Danny, his name is Danielle. They call him Danny. They called me Stevie.
Uh-huh.
But I was the junior. But anyway, yeah.
Oh, wow.
He's 2 years younger than me, but I could get him back in. I probably can't get him now.
You can't get him now.
Nah, I let him have it now. I would acquiesce.
So we're going to go back. The moment you realized he was a black man.
Here's how I feel about that. The era that I grew up in, I never did not know I was not a black boy.
Right.
That's known a black man.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in the era when, of course, civil rights were really strong. And we had back in the day when I was at Voluntown, what was called a black Mondays.
Right.
When we didn't go to school on the Monday. We didn't do school. No. Because of the sanitation worker strike and all of that, that was taking place at the time. So on Mondays, black parents would keep their children at home.
Why not? I don't understand that.
Yeah, because there was a protest for the civil rights, whether it was the sanitation worker strike and all that. So on those Mondays, the word would get out and parents would literally keep their children at home from school on that Monday, Black Monday.
So wait a minute. As a kid, you realized.
I realized. I knew the racial discrimination that was taking place even as a kid.
Right.
Yeah, because I knew what the textbooks looked like in certain schools and what they looked at like where I attended. However, our school, we were blessed, the community that we lived in, but I knew about the other schools and you would hear about the kind of textbooks that they would have and things like that. I was well aware of those issues because my father was also involved in the political arena with his colleagues, with the faith-based group. So a lot of my dad is really in me. And, of being community. My father was the organizer of the Northeast Shelby Community Action Agency, where his church was located. It's the suburbs now. It was the country then.
Right.
And so he organized the Northeast Shelby Community Action Agency and allowed people not to have to come to the city to get their commodities.
Man, you are really... Your life is like in line with the legacy that your dad laid.
In line with the legacy of my dad. I didn't even know all these things, how God was really shaping me. And now I'm so involved in the political landscape with the faith-based community and so many different. And then people call me and say, Bishop, we need you here and your voice at the table, that kind of thing. I never had to ask to be at a table.
Wow.
And that's the blessing from the Lord. That's another now unto him who is able.
Right.
You don't owe anybody. And then you can speak freely your position.
Right.
When you're at a table, when you've been invited to a table. Don't invite me and you don't want me to be me. I got to be me when you invite me to a table.
Right.
And that way I know that I'm really being true to who I am and helping the people I've been called to serve. Mm. Yeah.
When as a person did you know that you were going to be okay? When did you know that you could look in the mirror and say, you know what, this thing called life, I can do this?
Well, let me go back just a little bit, because when I grew up and was called a priest, the only thing you wanted to do was preach.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about a large church. It wasn't about a mega sized church. Memphis doesn't have a lot of churches that's over where you have over 1,000 people,
right?
Which our congregation is that. But when I was called to preach, all I wanted to do was preach. That was it. I had no vision sitting down or I'm going to have a church this size, because it just wasn't the talk. If you had a church, period, you were happy. You know,
really?
And the first church, only other church I ever applied for was because a deacon that I had preached for at that church over in Marion, Arkansas, West Memphis, Marion. Mm-hmm. He invited me to come. I went out of respect to him.
Okay.
It was a vacant church that he knew about. I went out of respect. I got there. I knew that wasn't God, but I went out of respect to him. But the only church really I know that was where I am currently serving. And so that's what.
So you never worried about taking care of your family or you know, as a kid, man, how am I going to do this thing? Or when I
went
to school,
I've had other jobs than this. I worked for the airlines. You know, I worked in retail. I was assistant buyer. I've done several things.
So in the midst of you following your dream of pastoring a church.
Oh, yeah. Let me say this to any young pastor who may be listening to me. You may have to be bivocational.
Bivocational.
Yeah. You may need to be bivocational for a season. you know, but my wife was very supportive, especially when I was called to the church. It was minuscule. It was, you know, but it was, I guess, okay, probably at that time.
Right.
And, but I believe that that's where I was supposed to be. We had no, I had no secretary. I had none of that. None. I mean, none.
Right.
But I stayed at it, kept developing, kept teaching.
Right.
And they recognized, Bishop, you got to get some help. We got to get you some help in here. Then I had a secretary who's still a member of the church. She's not a secretary now, but she's still a member of the church. And I remember my first secretary. So the church began to grow. And it was my pastor that I learned about staffing.
Right.
And doing ministry and giving ministry away. Because you never grow until you learn how to give areas of ministry away. You will forever limit yourself and be in a box until, hear me clearly, any young pastor, until you can learn to trust other people with the vision that God has given you, you will not grow. That's when I really began to see the church take off like it took off. Now, we were having good numbers, but giving ministry away and trusting other people with that God has given to you is when you start to really mushroom. For us, that's when I started really seeing the numbers just started,
right?
You know,
right?
Like I think, yeah,
altar call and everything got bigger, huh?
Oh, it got bigger. It got enormous.
All right, now when you looked across the room and saw that lady that you asked to be Mrs., tell us about that moment.
Well, actually, my wife and I went to junior high school together.
Okay.
She was a green and she was a cheerleader.
Okay.
Yeah, and she was also...
Look at him smiling. He started smiling when he started thinking about it.
She was a cheerleader, and she was a year older than I was.
Okay.
And, you know, she acts as though now she doesn't really remember the details of the story like I recant them. But I have the one with accuracy.
Okay.
And since I got the mic today.
Right.
And this is going to go out all over the world. This is the story.
Okay.
So she was a cheerleader, and we actually, let me fast forward. Wasn't no dating back then. She was a year older than me. She knew I existed. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, but we actually met at 10 years later at a mutual friend's wedding.
Right.
And, another mutual friend of ours who brought her to the wedding. I was a gentleman. I said, is she with you? He said, no, she just rolled with me. I said, gotcha.
I'll take it from here.
I got it from here. So the rest is history. We've been married now 40 years. We have three sons.
Uh-huh.
And they are 37, 33,
34, 37,
and
31. Okay.
Yeah, and so they all went to HBCUs. All of our children have done well and got the education. One went to Fisk, one went to Howard, and one went to Hampton.
Okay.
Yeah, and so...
Those Howard-Hampton conversations really...
I'm sure. I guess they had. Yeah, so they all married. We have... We have six grandchildren.
Okay.
Currently, yeah.
Okay.
And three boys and three girls.
Okay.
Yep. And they're from 5 and a half down to probably 9 or 10 months.
Oh, wow.
It's a wonderful
thing.
That's beautiful. Grandkids
are
amazing.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. All right, let's talk about your career.
Okay.
You've built this church. What is your vision as you look at where you are today? And you mentioned about the scripture that is your superpower. Where do you see, and then where do you think it could go?
Well, to continue what we're doing, my middle son is the executive pastor. My oldest son is the COO of our school, Academy.
Okay.
Charter schools, not connected to our church. It's our development corp. It operates under the Development Corporation.
Right.
But it's one thing to be a church in the community, another thing to be a church of the community.
Right.
And that's the key for us, being of. I say all the time, and I raise the question to other leaders, is that if our church was no longer in the community, would we be missed? That's it. Would we be missed?
Right.
And I want to believe without a doubt the answer is absolutely Golden Gate. Where is Golden Gate? So we miss them. They are such a vital link to Memphis,
right?
Not just Raleigh, but to Memphis, not just Memphis, but to the state, because wherever I am, I'm doing the work of the Lord and doing what I do. So they're part of the state. Now, I also have seven states that operate under my regional jurisdiction as a part of the Full Gospel Baptist Church Fellowship. They are part of that as well.
Right.
So I think that's important, not just being in something, but being of something.
Right.
And so I want to believe without a doubt that if Golden Gate Cathedral, and that's our official name, if they were no longer, we would be missed. That's the key. And I've said this over and over to our congregation. We just can't be a church that's a beautiful, and it's a beautiful edifice,
right,
but we just can't be over here and that's it. We have to be an integral part of what's going on. So as a result, very little happens. And I don't get a call and say, Bishop, we need you at the table. What's your thoughts about this? I don't get the big head about that, but I'm glad to be invited. I'm glad to be a significant contributor to what's going on in our city and surrounding areas.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Take you back to North Memphis. You and me, we walk in and you say, man, that's the house I used to live in as a kid. We walk up to the door, open the door. It's little Ed Stevens sitting right there at the table eating a bowl of cereal. What would you say to the younger you if you could go back and talk to him today?
Oh, wow. How old is the younger me?
Let's say 10.
10.
Your dad's still there. Mom's there. Everything.
I would say to him, you're blessed and don't know it.
Mm. Why? Why would you say that?
I would say that I would tell little Ed, you're blessed beyond your wildest imagination and don't know it. Because the world that I grew up in, my testimony is not wondering where my next meal was going to come from.
Right. Okay. Okay. Last question, last statement. I'm actually last request, actually. I want you to look right in that camera. That one right there. And I want you to leave everyone that's listening, everyone that's viewing, leave them with a Bishop Stevensism, something that they can take from this moment that they can carry with them.
I will not and cannot be redundant. You may take it as redundant, but here it is. Ephesians 3:20. I don't just say that as words, it's now unto him. And it's found in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 20. Now unto him. God has to be your source. I don't care what you're trying to do, trying to scrapple and make money and all that stuff, it's going to wane out unless God is at the foundation of what you are involved in. He can get you there when other doors shut. Don't worry about it, because if you know he's your force, he's your driving force when doors shut. Hey, another door that's probably, you only been walking through a single door. God's probably getting ready to open up a garage door, a triple door for you. That's what I'm trying to tell you. But don't try to navigate life without God. Now unto him who is able to do exceedingly, listen at me, exceeding. Do you know that? God knows how to cross over, clear the path, and work some stuff out for you. Now unto him who's able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power of the word that works in us. Now, that means you got to start reading some scripture. I'm not trying to make you a theologian, but you got to start reading some word. Take you one word and make that your word for the day, your word for the week. Don't try to read no chapter and say, I went through the whole Bible. I didn't ask you to do that. I'm telling you to get you a victory verse that becomes your verse that you can hold on to. And you're going to see your life change, because God will begin to manifest himself through that word for your life. And as I tell people all the time, remember, you are on the mind of God.
Wow. Not obligated to win. You're not obligated to win, but you're obligated to keep trying to do your best every day. And if you got your victory verse, if you got that you can hold on to, don't matter. You're going to be fine. So just keep coming back. We're going to keep bringing you these great icons. I'm Larry Robinson for our guest, Brother Ed Stevens.
Thank you for the invite again,
Bishop
Brother Larry.
Ed Stevens. You're watching The Journey on the Kazukiya Network. Till next time.
Thank you to our partners, the Delta Boule and Tennessee Valley Authority. To hear more incredible stories like this, be sure to download the Kazukian app from the App Store or Google Play. Or check out the Journey Memphis podcast on all your major podcast providers. Also, check us out on the Kazukian Network.
Support for WYXR comes from Lens Rentals. Based in Memphis and offering nationwide shipping, Lens Rentals offers online rentals for photography, videography, and lighting equipment from a full catalog of brands. More information on services and equipment at lensrentals.com. Support for WYXR, including our 2024 stereo sessions, comes from VIA Productions. Founded in 2003, VIA specializes in audience engagement, creating all types of video and audio content ranging from animation to documentaries. More information on how VIA can bring your brand story to life at viaproductions.co.
GPAC Concerts in the Grove series kicks off Thursday, September 19th, and you're invited to experience live music with food trucks and fun for the whole family. Featuring performances by Memphis Symphony Orchestra Big Band, Nick Black, Rachel Maxam, and more. More information on the concert schedule and tickets at gpacweb.com.
I don't know, everybody wants their name on the marquee. My name don't have to be on the marquee.
Mm-hmm.
I just want us to do something that we're going to make have an impact.
This is a journey.
Let me take you on a journey.
There will still be
the journey.
The journey.
New sheriff in town, and his name is
the journey.
Journey.
This thing is bigger than Nino Brown. This is
the journey.
The journey.
What is it that moved you?
The journey.
Welcome back to another episode of The Journey. I'm your host, Larry Robinson, and today we have a Memphis icon that didn't start in Memphis, but he is Memphis now. He's a Memphian through and through. He may not claim it, but he is. But before we get to that, I got a quote. And this quote comes from the great Martin Luther King. And it goes like this. Almost always, the creative, dedicated minority has made the world better. Why is this quote special for this conversation? This brother came from Somerville, Tennessee, but he's built multiple businesses, family, and everything. He has made Memphis better beyond a shadow of a doubt. I'm talking about Sylvester Tate, visionary, entrepreneur, leader, son, husband, and father. And besides all that, he's an amazing, amazing man. And I want to say again, a leader. Without further ado, Brother Sylvester Tate.
Thank you,
Dad. What's happening, Captain?
I'm just glad to be here, man.
Oh, man, shoot. I'm honored to be here with you, man.
Likewise.
Like I said, I've watched you for so long, and I've admired your steps with Tate Computing and now with Rain Event Services, Event Facility. I mean, and how you've integrated your kids into what you're doing. I admire that. I truly admire that, and just want to give you your flowers today on that
you.
One. So listen, we're going to go back. Okay. Tell me about early years, you know, your first early memories in Somerville, Tennessee. What was it like? What was the household like? And
gosh, that's going way back.
Right.
It's a reality, you know, who I am today.
Okay.
You know, with nine of us in a house, four-room house.
Nine?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I have four brothers and four sisters.
Okay.
And of course, you got your parents there. So that's right. 11 people in a four-room house. So that,
right.
You know, that is where I came from. You know?
Okay.
My first school I went to was a three-room school with grade 1 through 8.
In the three rooms.
And it wasn't always three rooms. It was two for a very long time.
Wow.
They actually moved a building next to the two rooms and made it a third room. So we had like 5th through 8th grade over there, but everything else was 1 through 4.
Wow.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I really go back to when things were really tough, you know, no inside toilets. We lived so far off the road that when it rained, we had to have a wagon to take us to the road to catch the bus.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So, wow. Okay.
So that's, okay. You know, that's where I came from.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So let me ask you, in Somerville, who outside of your parents and those in the house with you had the biggest impact on young Sylvester Tate?
You know, I had one teacher, a fifth grade teacher.
Really?
Her name was Miss Vassar.
Okay.
She just kind of took me under her arms, and I had cavities in my mouth. She took me to the dentist. She just embraced me, and, you know, and I loved her for it. And she just, you know, and, you know, I was always a person that paid attention to other people around me. And
right.
So that's kind of where I got my desire to be more than where I came from, because, you know, I looked at, you know, the teachers and the teachers' kids, and I paid attention to, you know, them.
Right.
And so as I got in high school, I wanted to date the teachers' daughters. And
oh,
so,
wow.
And of course, you know, I was in a different economic background
right.
than the traditional, I mean, not the traditional, but, you know, the kind of people that they wanted their kids to date, you know. So I ended up dating this teacher's daughter, but I knew then that I had to keep my grades up. I had to be on point all the time, because back then, you know, the parents want to see your report card.
Right.
So I would have to show my report card to the girl's parents, you know, in order to, but, you know, they still, you know, they didn't like me.
They didn't like you?
They didn't like me. They thought, you know, I wasn't good enough for their daughter.
Wow. I wonder what they say now.
You know. Yeah, exactly.
So what decision as a young person did you make that you probably didn't know it at the time ended up having lifelong impact on Sylvester Tate?
When I joined the Navy.
Really?
Yeah.
What made you join the Navy?
Because I was in a rut.
Okay.
I was in a rut and I wanted to get out of it and I wanted to go back to school.
Okay.
And of course, 9 kids in the house, you know, there's not a lot of money to send you to school. Or I had gone to school to be a welder when I first got out of high school.
Okay.
And I realized early on that I didn't want to do that the rest of my life.
Right.
And I wanted to do something that I didn't have to use my hands so much, you know.
Right, right.
So I got a job working at a company, and I ran into some issues with that company on trying to get promoted and getting into the OJT program.
Right.
So I was
OJT, like, for y'all, is on the job training.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And so I ended up start looking at my options to get out, and I started asking people what branch of service to go to, because I knew that it was peacetime, there was no wars going on, you know. And so everybody kept coming back to Navy, the Navy, the Navy. So I joined the Navy, and that's when I got into electronics.
Okay.
And that's what helped propelled me to where I am today, being in technology, getting into technology.
Do you remember the day you said, you know what, I'm going to do this. I'm going to the Navy. Do you remember that day?
I do.
What was that day like?
It was a day that actually I took all of the employees at the company, and we did a walk-in to the corporate office at the where I was working.
Uh-huh.
And we were demanding some things, and they told us, if you don't get out of here with this foolishness, we're going to fire all of y'all, right?
Really?
So I wasn't afraid.
Right.
But the other guys, they were married, they had families and things like that. So they backed down. And so that was when I knew I had to get out of there.
Whoa.
And so that's when I went and joined the Navy.
How different are you from the person you dreamed you'd be as a young person?
You know, I didn't really have any dreams as a young person of what I wanted to be. I had no idea when I got out of high school what I wanted to be or what I wanted to do. And the reason I went into welding was because a friend of mine graduated. He got a really, really good job with Chicago Bridge and Iron welding, you know, making lots of money, you know, driving a new car. So I wanted to do that. You know?
Right.
And of course, I didn't, my studies didn't take me down that same path. So, so I just knew that I had to do something different, you know.
At what point in your life did you know that you were going to be okay? That you were like, I can do this thing called life?
You know, it's interesting that I had so many journeys on the way to getting where I got, you know, but I was always a thinker and I always paid attention to everything that went on around me, even when in the Navy. But after I got in the Navy, I realized there was a difference between enlisted and officers. I did not know that.
Mm.
And so when I got in, I wanted to be an officer.
Right.
You know, I've always wanted to be up here, not down here, right?
Right.
And so when I got in, we used to have to do watch in what they call a ready room.
Right.
And all the employees, all the military people checks would be in the drawer.
Uh-huh.
So I was looking at those checks and I'm looking at the officer's check versus the enlisted checks.
Right.
I'm like, I'm going to be one of them. If I'm going to stay in here, or I'm going to get out. You know?
Right, right.
And so I decided to get out after 7 years, stayed in the reserve until I retired. Of course, now I get all the benefits of as if I had stayed in for 20 years. But,
wow.
But that was you know, kind of things that woke me up. And then when I got out, I went to work for a company, and one of the guys was a retired Navy guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I realized I was smart enough to do what they were doing.
Right.
So they was in the office equipment business. And so that's kind of how I started my company in the office equipment business.
Wow.
And so that was the beginning of the journey with, you know, I had two partners at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They bailed out on me after about 4 years.
Yeah.
I mean, 4 months.
Tough.
4 months.
Times get tough, you know.
4 months. They were gone, you know. And, you know. And
well, I'm going to ask you on the other side after the break, I'm going to ask you about what made you keep going? Because so many times your boys will stop and you'll be like, I'm going to go with them. But what made you keep going? But my last question of this segment, and most brothers have a moment that they can really point to, but I want to know yours. When was that moment that you realized, when you looked in the mirror or realized that you were a black man? Hold on for a quick second. Listen, we're going to come right back. Brother Sylvester Tate is going to share with us when he realized he was a brother. Listen, this is The Journey on the Kadzukian Network. We'll be right back after this. Don't go nowhere.
This is a journey.
Let me take you on a journey.
Welcome to Her Journey, presented by Kadzukian Media Group. We believe Her Journey will encourage young women and help them see that life is a journey.
You have to continue to walk in your purpose.
We cannot control how other people respond to us.
As long as you have breath in your body, story does not end. Every day that God grants you, you have an opportunity to rewrite your story.
Our mission is clear: to inspire and empower the next generation of women leaders, innovators, and change makers. Her Journey chronicles the trials, tribulations, and triumphs of 10 phenomenal women right here in Memphis, Tennessee, who have pretty successfully navigated this thing called life. Watch Her Journey, hosted by me, Joy Doss, brought to you by the Kadzukian Media Group and proudly sponsored by Nike, Black Community Commitment.
Welcome back to The Journey. We have Brother Sylvester Tate, and before he left, he was going to share with us when he realized he was a brother. But before we get there, I got another question. What's your superpower? What's that one thing that you do better than anybody that you know?
Multitask.
Really?
Yes.
Man, no brothers multitask. No men that I've never met a man that can multitask. I don't think we were born with that gene.
I am a serious multitasker.
Really?
It's drive people crazy too.
Really?
Yeah. I can listen and do something at the same time. And I'm just, you know, but I think that because of the way I started my company, you know, because I did everything in the company. It was just me.
Right.
So and it just became a part of who I am, you know, being able to multitask.
So it was your entrepreneurial pursuit that led you to know that, oh, this is a skill of mine.
Yes, it is.
Wow, hey, bro, I've never met a man. Now, there's a couple women, but I've never met a man that can multitask effectively.
Everybody knows it as well, especially my daughter. It drives her crazy because she's talking to me and I'm doing something on the computer. I said, I heard everything you said, you know, because I'm, you know, if I could not multitask, I would not be where I am today, you know.
Wow.
Because I have to, you know, I have to be thinking about what I'm going to do next, what I'm doing now, and then the phone ring.
Right? Yeah,
so
exactly.
I got all of that going on, but I, you know, I keep it intact. And, you know, it kind of bothers me now because as I've aged, I don't remember as clearly as I used to.
Right.
So it kind of drives me crazy that I don't have all the skill sets that I had because I'm losing some of it because this brain has worked so hard over the
years. Hey, man, get you some sea moss. You'll be all right.
Oh, I have some. I just got to remind myself to take it every
there
day.
You go. There you go. Hey, man, sea moss is the truth. Okay. So you're walking down the street, Memphis, you're walking down Main Street. This guy looks up. He sees you. He comes over to you. And he said, hey, man, who are you? How would you respond?
I just say, I'm nobody.
Really?
I do. I mean, I actually had people that say, you must be somebody. Who are you?
Uh-huh.
I said, I'm just an ordinary guy. Just out here working and making way for myself.
But you lying.
But that's really the truth.
Is it? Why you say that's the truth? I'm curious because I know somebody that I would say is very much somebody. Well, so why do you say you're nobody?
Because I don't feel like I'm beyond anyone, you know, in my business and my accomplishment have not changed me at all. You know, I'm still going to return every phone call. You know, I'm going to acknowledge everybody I knew before. Whereas I've seen some people that I, you know, business has grown and they total demeanor changed, you know.
Mm.
I mean, I had one brother, man, I couldn't even call him on the phone anymore and he returned my call, you know, and that's what money do to people. And I vowed that would never happen to me, is be beyond where I came from. And he used to be really humble because we started at the same time and it was always, hey, take this, hey, take that. And then he just, you know, just changed, you know.
Wow.
So it's a reality that, you know, economic change people, you know, but I'm not that person. But, you know, I don't take that lightly that I'm nobody. I mean, I know that I am somebody, but I don't want people to think that I think I'm more than they are or anybody else.
Right.
That's kind of the way I look at that when I answer that way.
I got you.
Yeah.
All right. Before we left the other side, I ask you, what was that moment that you realized that you were a brother, when you realized you were a black man? Is there a specific moment in your life you can point to?
Well, you know, where I came from, it was pretty obvious that you were a black man because there were signs up there, white only, you know.
Oh, so you were in that era where?
Oh, yeah. You know, the schools was not segregated back then. And, you know, so in the 7th or 8th grade, I went to a all-white school, and it was a volunteer basis.
Right.
And, you know, we would walk home in the evenings, and we walked by the laundromats and all of these places, and it was a white here, colored here. And there was a restaurant called The Hut in Somerville, uh-huh. Tennessee. It was a barbecue place.
Right.
You can go inside and eat. You had to go to the window to order. And,
wow.
You know, I was riding with this motorcycle group, and one day we went out there, and they wanted to stop there and eat. And they, of course, you know, now you can go inside. And
right.
I said, no, I'm not going in there. I couldn't go back in. Back then, I'm not going in there now and eat, you know.
So you won't support them at all?
Oh, no, never, ever will they get a dime of mine. I won't even go to the window.
Wow.
You know, but okay. I saw a lot of that growing up, you know, white only, colored here. We even had a football scrimmage in like the 8th grade,
mm-hmm.
where if the white boy got the ball, you could not tackle him.
What?
You could not tackle him.
It wasn't football.
He was the sheriff's son or something, right? And one day this black kid tackled him.
Uh-huh.
And all hell broke loose, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And it was the same year the schools became segregated. Desegregated,
yeah.
And it was just a lot of bottle throwing, and windows blowing, a lot of tension. And
yeah.
So after that, the school was, they zoned us all back into our area where where you lived. You had to go to the school in your area. So
right.
I had to leave that school and go back to the original school I went to. But then, of course, most of the white kids, they went to Fed Academy, which at that time was a private school for only white kids.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's integrated, so they got black kids paying to go to that school. But back then, you couldn't even pay to go back, you know, to the private school.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, and then, you know, I was telling you about the OJT program
right.
that I was a part of. And that was, so the company I was working for, it was very segregated.
Mm-hmm.
It was blacks worked in the back. And the white guys was the machinists.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to become a machinist because they made a lot more money than we did in the back, you know, when we were doing punch press operations.
Right.
And I was doing the welding and punch pressing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I came up with solutions. I had some of those machines running automatically and all that stuff. So, you know, here I am, this brilliant kid. And so I find out about the OJT program. And I, you know, go to the front office, say, hey, I want to be an OJT program, you know. So I'm the next one up, right? And then they bring in this white kid and make him put him in the program and just overlook me. That's kind of how I ended up in the Navy, because that really fueled the fire in me and burned me up. And, you know, I knew racism was real, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we all find out different kind of ways.
Oh, yeah.
But it happens. It happens. So tell me about going back to school, man. I mean, so you in high school, you I'm imagining you playing football. Or were you? Were you playing sports?
I played football.
What was that like, you know, in that process of graduating from high school and then to trying to determine where you were? But what was it like in high school?
So high school was, you know, I wasn't the brightest kid, but I was capable of learning. Because once I made my mind up that I wanted to get good grades,
right?
Because of the girls I was dating, I did excellent. I mean, I was AB student all the way through.
You just had to be motivated.
My junior senior year, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't really caring before, you know.
Right.
But once I wanted to start dating these smart girls, you know, they all on the dean list and all that stuff.
Right.
So, you know, I really stepped up my game, you know, and became I had a. My brother played football too. He was a year ahead of me.
Okay.
And I didn't play my senior year because my mom would not sign the papers for me to play, because my brother I was next to, his first semester in college, he died from cancer. He had a knot on his leg, and he had a football scholarship.
Oh,
and he was at UT Martin, and the first semester he went to school, he had this knot on his leg, and they kept just putting him in the whirlpool and letting him soak it and stuff, you know. They thought it was just a bruise and stuff, you know, and all, you know, all kind of misdiagnosis was going on with him. And so when he got to school, they sent him to Memphis to the hospital, and that's when they found out that he had cancer. By the time they found out, it was too late to do anything. It had spread all through his body, you know. So he was 19 years old. So me and him was really close, you know, because, you know, there was time we hit the same person and knocked the guy over a fence in Collierville playing football, you know. But he was a real football player. I always tell people he was out of way out of poverty, and he didn't make it, you know, because the school had not even won a football game since it had been desegregated until he played at running back.
Wow.
You know, he was a serious, you know, contender.
What was that like to lose?
That was tough for the family, you know, because we were real close.
What was it like for you?
It was really tough for me because I was so.
But y'all being so close.
Him being so strong and so motivated and so energetic, because he was like a little bull, right? You know, he was really like the healthiest one of us, you know? And the first time I saw him in the hospital and he didn't have that just really took a lot out of me. And it really, you know, I knew something was seriously wrong, because he couldn't even stand up without getting dizzy. You know, he had to sit down, you know, all the time.
Oh,
so that was, you know, that first visit really took a lot out of me, you know. And, you know, they had said he was coming home the week that he passed, and he never came back home, you know. So that was my senior year. But, you know, I was participated in a lot of clubs and organizations in school, and you know, just, you know, graduated.
Were you the life of the party?
No, I was not. I tell people that I wouldn't even dance. I was scared to dance and stuff. You know, I was
really
a shy kid. Yeah,
really.
I was afraid to dance in public and stuff like that, because I didn't think I was ever a good enough dancer. You know, because some of the kids can really dance.
Right.
You know, our kids will make fun of you.
Right.
Back then, so you don't do nothing that's gonna embarrass yourself. You know.
Well, I see my daddy's still embarrassing himself because he can't dance worth the darn. And we give him the blues. He'd
well,
be like,
I think
whatever.
I think I can now, but my kids, they have a ball marking me.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so I got the same groove. I say, hey, that's what we get when we get to age.
There you go. So Tell me about your experience in Memphis. What has Memphis meant to Sylvester Tate?
You know, wherever I am, I like to make an impact on the community. And so my goal when I started my company was to hire people that look like me.
Okay.
Because of my experience, I was in the Navy. My last tour of duty was stationed here in Millington.
Oh, okay.
And I was going to school at Southwest at night, okay. You know, in electronics. Yeah. So I'm way ahead of most of these kids in the class because I've already gone through all these military schools. My whole entire 7 years in the military, I went to every class they offered me. You know, I was an aircraft electronic guy.
But why? What made you say I'm gonna do this? I'm gonna take the initiative. What about you inspired?